Hi, and welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Megan Figueroa.
And I'm Carrie Gillen.
I was nervous that I was going to forget the introduction, even though you were doing it this time.
That's a new fear.
Yeah. Hopefully this one passes. It's nice to know that you can still have podcasting fears going into, like, after 4.5 years.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Sure, it's not as scary as, like, being video recorded or filmed, but still.
Oh, yeah, no. Video is way worse, because then you're like, what am I doing with my hands? Oh, am I moving my mouth too much? What am I doing?
Well, with me, it's like, where are my eyebrows going? Like, why do they keep going so high and over there? So.
Yeah. I guess I don't use my eyebrows as much, so I don't worry about it.
Yeah. No, I have very expressive facial things.
Although now, that makes me worry, do I have dead eyebrows?
Is that a
thing? Do you know this podcast?
No. Called Dead Eyebrows?
Dead Eyes. It's called Dead Eyes.
No.
Okay, I've been listening to it. I'm so into it. So this actor, Connor Ratcliffe, I think is his name. Anyway, he's been in some things like Search Party.
Oh! Love that.
Yeah. He's the brother-in-law of the woman they go searching for.
Oh my god.
So, anyway, the premise of this entire podcast is that back in, like, 2000, he was fired from an acting job because supposedly Tom Hanks thought that he had dead eyes. It's bizarrely good because it's just about this one thing, one moment in his life that kind of, like, blew up his life and then...
Is he the host of it?
Yeah. Oh. And it's charming. He's very charming. And somehow it's really interesting to listen to. I mean, it's all about, like, Hollywood and what it's like to be an actor and, like, how hard it is. And but it's just, I don't know. Like, I'm really enjoying it.
That's interesting. No, I could see how that'd be a fun listen. And I don't think Tom Hanks would say you have dead eyes.
Well, everyone's surprised by it. But, yeah. Anyway. He hasn't yet spoken to Tom Hanks about it, but he has spoken to his son, Colin
Chet?
Hanks.
Oh.
Oh! Chet's not an actor.
I know. Oh, but he talks to Colin about this very thing that his dad said, and then other stuff, I'm sure.
And other stuff.
Yeah.
It's good. Just, I don't know. Give it a shot. But anyway, so maybe I have dead eyebrows.
Maybe a Tom Hanks in the future will tell you that your eyebrows are just dead. they're not conveying much.
So I thought we've had some emails, and I'm like so bad about keeping track of them, but we had a couple more recently, and I thought we should address them.
Yeah.
So
just to let you know, we have fans.
I don't know if you've heard, but we've got fans. Okay, so this is from Angela. Hi, I just started listening to your podcast and I'm really enjoying it. I was listening to the last episode about Galician, and I love knowing that people find our minority languages here in Spain interesting. I'm from the Basque Country, and he definitely hit the nail on the head when he mentioned that these languages are politicized. I can only speak for the Basque Country, but there's a long history of Euskera being associated with the left and separatism, thanks to a very long, complicated history, as well as the Civil War and Franco's dictatorship, but I digress. I just wanted to show you guys these ladies who sing in Galician, just to show that these languages are used and loved, and there are people who are revindicating their mother tongue while making very cool things, and they may even represent Spain in Eurovision, which would be huge for a song not in Spanish. Yeah, hope you enjoy them.
That's super huge. I don't watch Eurovision, but I know how big that is, because there was just a Eurovision band that won that was on SNL. I mean, that's a marker of success, but that... This guy had very expressive eyebrows.
Interesting. Okay.
Okay. The band is Måneskin.
Oh. Okay.
Italian rock band.
Oh.
Glam rock. Yeah, so they won the Eurovision Song Contest 2021 for Italy.
Oh.
Yeah. So yeah, they were on SNL, and I mean, not that that makes, you know,
no, it's
someone
a big
successful,
deal.
But yeah, yeah. So no, it's really big to have like Galician singers on Eurovision.
Potentially, yeah, yeah, potentially singing for Spain. That would be big.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was really nice. Someone commented on our at us on Twitter saying that it is very likely that my name is from the northern area of Spain because of the fig part, which I had suspected that my last name was related to figs. So it's kind of a giveaway that it's related to figs, I think.
I mean, I didn't know. Sure, it sounds like it in English, but there's so many false friends. I don't
know. It's true. Yeah.
One more email. I'm a new listener. This is from Haley. I'm a new listener and really like the show. I wanted to know if you could explore the topic of glass windows and how they were used to communicate to the illiterate, as I love Gothic cathedral window art. And the answer is, we're interested, but have no idea how to explore that. So if any listeners have any idea how to even penetrate that topic,
yeah,
I'd be interested.
Yes, because you had me at Gothic. I love anything Gothic. But boy, do they know how to do a cathedral art.
Oh, yeah.
Window. Woo!
I mean, the Catholic churches in Europe are incredible. Like,
yeah,
incredible.
Sure. Yeah. I enjoy the biggest or the most famous one that I've been to probably is the one in D.C. And even that was, like, really impressive to me.
Yeah, there's some really beautiful ones in North America as well, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I could imagine that the ones that are in Rome are pretty great.
Never been to Rome, but I've been to other ones. And yeah, they're incredible. Like, they spent hundreds of years building them. Like,
yes.
It's just a different level.
That's what makes it so Gothic. Oh, how many people died making this? How many hauntings are there? At least one. Yes.
At least one.
Yeah.
So, speaking of hauntings, although not really.
Oh. Well, that's just teasing me.
I can't believe that you missed this, but this is definitely going to be a submission for Euphemism of the Year.
Okay.
I guess by the end of this year, who knows, maybe it'll be long gone forgotten memory. But to me, it's like a really amazing euphemism.
Okay.
The headline is 90 tons of U.S. military aid arrives in Ukraine as border tensions with Russia rise.
Okay.
But in the tweet about it, it's called lethal aid.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, wait. So the tweet, like, that summarizes the article in one sentence or whatever, calls it lethal aid.
So, yeah, that's that's what the United States is calling it. They're calling it lethal aid, and then NPR just parroted it in their tweet, and people were pretty mad about that. But it is the term that the U.S. government is using. So
this is like their official term they're going with what they sent to Ukraine.
I mean, I don't know about official, but yeah, it's the term they were using with the media, and some of the people in the media were just using it.
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to believe. It's not going to have any staying power, but it's a very impressive euphemism.
I don't know. You think it's going to be gone? I mean, how much lethal aid does the U.S. give around the world? Like,
that's true.
Israel, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so just not using it in this context, so you think it's going to be used in other cases where the U.S. is doing the same thing.
Yeah, I think this is going to be the new, unless they got mocked so harshly and they're like, okay, never mind, we can't use this anymore. But I doubt it. This seems exactly like the kind of terminology that the U.S. government would use.
Wow.
Going forward. And I could be wrong. We'll find out.
Yeah. But the fact that they used the intentional use of it as if it makes it better somehow. Or, yeah.
Right.
Ameliorates the situation somehow.
Right. Because they clearly understand that giving military aid, giving weapons to another country, doesn't look great. Right?
Right.
They've been doing it basically for I don't know, very, very long time. Decades, at the very least. Probably longer than that.
Oh.
So it's just a thing that the United States government does, but people, a lot of people find it very upsetting. And, that, you know, that's not even, like, necessarily, like, on the political alignment chart. Like, there's plenty of people on all sides of the alignment chart who don't want the United States government to be giving arms right. to other countries. Right. Anyway, yeah, so today's episode,
yeah.
we talk about Jesse Greaser's new book coming, which is Yay. Come out. Or is it coming out? It's coming out. It's coming out tomorrow, as of the, this coming out. So, yeah.
I mean, could we have planned this better?
We could not.
We couldn't have. And check out the book. And the book cover is just so gorgeous. I am just obsessed with all these book covers of these books that we get to read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So anyway.
Really
cool. Books.
Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. It's free, and they have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. And you can also make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
So we are so excited to have Jesse Greaser here today, fellow linguist, someone I've admired for a long time. Hi.
It's totally mutual.
So Jesse is an associate professor of linguistics in the Department of English at the University of Tennessee. Her research focuses on the use of African-American English style in the creation and maintenance of identities, which are not necessarily ethno-racial in nature, particularly identities of place and class. Her book, which has the most gorgeous cover, The Black Side of the River, Race, Language, and Belonging in Washington, D.C., will be out February 1st. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
It is my pleasure.
Yeah, I have to ask about the cover. Did you have a lot of say in how that would go?
I had no say in it whatsoever.
Really?
The really hilarious part was that they asked for suggestions, what should we put on the cover? And the bridge which appears there is the Frederick Douglass Bridge has actually just been redone in D.C. And this is actually sort of a metaphor that I even use in the book, is thinking about these bridges that have been remodeled in the neighborhood. And so I was like, oh, it'd be cool to like superimpose the new Frederick Douglass Bridge over the old one. And they were just shot that down and went, no, we want something with movement and color. We're thinking the roller skating rink. And I said, you know, fine, whatever. But then the Frederick Douglass Bridge is what ended up on the cover. But it's this lovely old picture from the 50s that the cover designers did. So I'm super pleased with it. And I think it really conveys that this is a book that's meant to be not just for people with lots of linguistic training. Like, it's meant for people who are interested in this area. And it's written that way.
I'm in awe. As Carrie and I are writing our own book, it's just like, it is hard to write a book, and yours is beautifully written, and I'm so glad that the cover worked out for you. It would just be terrible to have a cover that you didn't like.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no, I love that you say, okay, so the color, just like the attractiveness of the cover of the book will get people to be like, what's this? And the idea that it's not just for linguists, because I mean, the reason why we have podcasts is that we think linguistics shouldn't just be for linguists.
Right.
For people who consider themselves linguists. Anyway, why did you want to write this book?
So it came out of a couple of things. So one, from the very get-go, one of the reasons I went to Georgetown and did my graduate degree there was in part because I've always been interested in these questions of urban life and, you know, what it means to be from a city or in a city. I've always been fascinated by big cities. And so that really got me interested in thinking about language in the city. And Georgetown actually has this very large project called the Language and Communication in DC Project, the LCDC Project. And it spans multiple generations of graduate students. It's been going on since 2006. And so I saw that project and went, I would love to be a part of something like that. And then I got interested in Anacostia, the neighborhood that's in the book, because there was a really interesting gentrification pattern happening there when I started the work, which was that as people were getting pushed out of the rest of the city, this area was known as, it was almost entirely Black. So on the census, it's 94-95% Black alone. And so that's not even counting people like me who would check more than one box on the census, but who consider ourselves Black people. But the incomes were slowly rising, even as the neighborhood was staying just as African-American and even becoming even more African-American. And so this was this really unusual gentrification without race shifting pattern. And I thought that's going to be a really cool place to study language, and especially middle class Black language, which is what I was interested in at the time.
Yeah. So why did you want to study that language, the language of middle class Black people in DC?
Yeah, it's really understudied. And in fact, so Walt Wolfram wrote a couple of pieces in 2007 and 2015, in which he talks about this as being one of the myths of Black language study, is that that it's only a working class variety. And those were always the speakers who were privileged because they were the ones who were maximally different. And so you have these sort of white varieties, and it's going to be the working class men who are going to have the most number of features that are different from like rural white males who had been the focus of all the dialectology studies. And so what that led people to do was to kind of go, okay, you know, this is a working class variety. And of course it's not. There's all sorts of, there's a reason why when you listen to Michelle Obama on an audio tape, you know, like, oh, this is a Black woman I'm listening to. But it's not the same sorts of things that say the LeBov and Wolfram and some of the people who were doing this work really early on were identifying as parts of African-American language. So it's really a new, it's pushing us forward in our understandings in some interesting ways.
So how does Michelle Obama sound different from like the stereotypical idea of Black speakers that we have in our head?
Yeah. So one thing that is true of her speech is she uses a lot of Black intonational patterns. So you get different sentence contours than you would. The one in particular that I bring up as an example, because some of my work in on the sociophonetic side has dealt with final consonant devoicing, which is saying something like, I lived on 14th Street instead of I lived on 14th Street. And she does that left, right, and center, like to the point that I had the audible version of her autobiography and I could not listen to it. I had to just turn it off and read it because I was just sitting there doing a variationist analysis.
Yeah, you're like, this is a great corpus.
Right, exactly. And so one of the things that I hypothesize is going on with that feature is that people get told, oh, you know, you don't mumble, you got to say your endings, because removing that ending, right? So final consonant deletion is a really common feature of working class African-American language. And so middle class and upper class Black people really put it in there to the point that they almost overemphasize it as a way of like responding to that that sort of additional metalinguistic narrative, like, oh, you gotta enunciate, you have to keep your endings and don't mumble. And so all of those things come out.
So how does language help us create community? How do your interviewees, as would be a good example since we're here talking about your book, do this to create community?
They do it in a bunch of different ways. So one of the things that I first started out studying were just straight up what's in the language signal. And so I was looking at some of those working class African-American English features. Again, I was interested in this class difference thing. The book is really a story of me discovering, okay, it's not about class. It's actually about place. It was actually about how people were talking about the neighborhood. But I did a study looking at the actual morphosyntax of African-American English. So how often do you use habitual be? How often do you use an unexpressed copula and say, we cool, or something like that? And so I was counting all of that and looking at it by topic. And one of the things that people do is as they talk about the neighborhood, as they talk about gentrification, they use more and more of these Black language features, which I saw were lining up with talking about Black language and talking about Blackness more generally, and argue that like this is about making these places Black. And so you don't have to say it's Black if you sound really Black while you're talking about it. Right? And so these things come up this way. And you actually see the opposite happen with things like work, where it's typically this expectation you're going to use a more standardized variety. And people do that even when just talking about it, even if the interview setting hasn't changed. So that was really interesting. And that's one way. But then they also do a lot of really cool discourse things. And so there's things like, who gets defined as part of we? Like at one point in time, one of my interviewees said specifically, his name was Gus, and he said, it's going to become real bad for us out there. Us meaning Black folk. And just like really clarified that like I'm creating this big umbrella. Sometimes us was just the people from the neighborhood, or us was just Black DC. It was never white DC. And so white DC residents were never included in that deictic positioning of us versus them, right? So as we get who gets to be part of we, who gets to be part of us, who is them, allows residents to sort of say, ah, you know, them are the people who are coming in. And typically those people are racialized as white.
Will you tell us a little bit about the Anacostia to like put us in the place?
we should start there, right?
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah. That's why I put that question earlier.
I know. I was so confused. But now I see it.
Yeah, let me tell you about the neighborhood. So the neighborhood itself is fascinating. And it is, when you think about Black placemaking and Black place, it is Black place. So originally, it contained both white and Black DC residents. Actually, if we go back even further, it's really important to acknowledge that it is the land of the Nkotchtank people. And they got anglicized as the Nakostine, which then gave rise to the name Anacostia and Anacostia River. So the area is actually named after the native tribe whose land everybody's on. But then, back during the pre-Civil War era, the white workers of DC Naval Yard lived there, right across the bridge in a neighborhood called Uniontown. And then, after the Civil War in the Reconstruction era, the plantation that was there was sold via the Freedmen's Bureau and became a neighborhood called Hillsdale. And so Uniontown and Hillsdale were right next to each other, Hillsdale being this freed slave community, and Uniontown being this area of white workers in D.C. And it really stayed that way until about the 1960s in the Civil Rights era. And then D.C., if you're unaware, had a major, major race riot in 1968 that just absolutely decimated huge parts of the city, big parts of the existing African-American community that were there. And in that time, D.C. had a lot of white flight, and also a lot of educated and wealthy Black flight as well. And that was part of what created Prince George's County, which is the, to this day, essentially the biggest center of Black wealth in the country. There's all of these D.C. residents who moved out in the 60s and 70s. But that left this neighborhood being almost completely Black, and generally pretty working class, lower working class. But there had always been this presence of middle-class residents, and there had always been this income mixing in the neighborhood.
Of Black middle-class.
Of Black middle-class, yeah. Frederick Douglass, actually, was one of the first really educated, respected Black people to live in Uniontown, in that part of the neighborhood. So he actually like moved straight into the white part of the neighborhood. And so it's this neighborhood that has had this really rich Black history over the years. And so it was a really great place to think about, okay, how does Black language play into these Black placemaking identities?
Right. How are they making us in Anacostia?
Exactly.
And you're saying that there's this divide between neighborhood and work. And so I wonder, what kind of jobs are in the area? What are the working class jobs that people can have I know that they're different depending on what geographic region you're in. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, so one of the big things to know about DC is that a big reason why DC became, it was originally known as Chocolate City. That's the Funkadelic Parliament song that came out in 1970 about it. And so we sometimes talk about the chocolate cities in DC, Detroit, Atlanta, some of these cities that historically have had these large Black and especially Black middle class populations. The reason DC got that reputation was because of the federal government. And so one area of jobs that people would have, one of my interviewees once said, it's like, yeah, you know, you can finish high school in DC and you'll get a GS 3 or 4 job. And that's the government pay scale. And so you had these federal jobs that couldn't discriminate based on race. And so people came to DC so that they could get on the ladder and have these reasonably well-paying, but still usually sort of working class, middle working class kinds of jobs. But then from there, you start the generational movement where one person has been able to have a better job than they might have had in, say, North Carolina, which is where a lot of DC residents moved from. And then they're able to send their children to different schools. And then their children go to Howard University, which is the big HBCU in DC. And so then this engine starts to move.
So with the working class and then the middle class, are we seeing the same difference in talking about work? Are they changing the way that they, their lexical items, their syntax? Yeah.
That was actually the weird part of this study was that I went in and I'm like, oh, I'm going to look for differences in middle class and working class Black speech. And they weren't there. and
that is really interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think that's because it's DC and there's like particular economy there? Or is it, would you find this across the states? What do you think?
I think you'd find it across the states. That it turns out that, you know, if we take sort of more of a raciolinguistic approach and we're thinking about the ways that language is doing racial identities in particular ways, what we're really getting into is this this fact that what people are doing first and foremost is race, because that's how we divide our country, whether we like it or not, right? It's a very salient part of anyone's identity who's part of a minoritized race. And so it becomes a way of marking oneself as a part of that really important community. And possibly even for people who are, you know, like one of the tensions of being middle class and an African American is often that those two things are seen as being in conflict because we have in many ways raced African Americanness as being of lower class, uneducated. And you see these things come out in the ideologies people have around African American language. And so there are these subtle ways of reinforcing, no, like I may be married to the president of the United States, I am a Black woman first and foremost, right? And so you see these things come out.
And isn't Obama just this iconic example of how he switches from, so like when he's on the basketball court or he's like trying to, he's in the community, he will have more of this African-American language. And then we have him when he gives his speeches, which, you know, there are people that would say that he quote unquote sounds white.
Right, exactly. And he has some really interesting features that he uses and doesn't use. There's a very, very famous example that's brought up by Sami Alim and Geneva Smitherman in their book about Obama's speech when he was in a DC landmark, Ben's Chili Bowl. It's one of the few Black businesses to have survived the riots, to have survived the Big Dig.
It's that old.
It's that old. And so it goes way back. I think it's from the 50s, maybe late 40s is when their original place opened. And he had this wonderful day, not after he was inaugurated, he went in to get some chili and asked, paid with a $100 bill for something that was like 17 bucks or something. And the person says, oh, here's your change. And he goes, nah, we straight.
Yes.
And it's this whole conglomeration of phonological features and morphosyntactic features. And it was really a moment when the entire country sort of went, oh, we were really excited about having elected a Black man, but it turns out we elected a Black man.
Right. No, I actually got chills when you just said that because I think it's exciting that these different type of languaging are in our capital. Like, that's exciting to me. But like you said, a lot of people were like,
right, oops.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. We actually talked about this example with Nicole Holliday, too.
Yeah.
She brought it up because we were talking about Obama linguistics, basically.
I was going to bring up some of Nicole Holliday's work because one of the things that she's found is that Michelle Obama has a little bit more of a natural African-American language style.
Right.
And yeah. But it's true. That's something that I share in common with Barack Obama, is we're both raised in families with relatively standardized white speakers being our primary parents. And so for him, as it is for me, African-American language is a second dialect acquisition that we got a little later in life, and it shows.
Mm-hmm. So this is a good lead into the next question we have, is how do we do community via language, through language?
Lots and lots of different ways. And so you get things like who gets included and who doesn't. Like with my interviewees and their use of deixis, and do they say, is it us versus them? There's the kinds of narratives and stories about your community that you push back on. And so what do you anticipate that other people are saying about your community behind your back? And so, for example, in my book, one of the things that I discovered was that some of the stories that are being told about Anacostia, and you can imagine this, right? They're both racist and classist, but people in the rest of the city, you'll see in the Washington Post it being described of as the basement, the stepchild, the forgotten land. There's a joke map that I use in some of my talks that has it labeled. It has Georgetown labeled as Metroless Popped Collar Land, talking about all of the prepsters in Georgetown. Conversely, that entire area of D.C. that contains Anacostia is described as the zone of perceived danger on this same
perceived
joke map.
Danger. Yes. Yeah.
And so you get those sorts of things in circulation. And so what happens is, even without prompting, like, I'm not talking about that map, I'm not bringing up, like, oh, what do other people think of your neighborhood? Unprompted, my interviewees would give me evidence that the neighborhood was safe. They would talk about how beautiful it was. They would talk about how many middle and upper class people lived there. And you can tell that there's these other things circulating about poverty and about filth and about lack of safety. And you're just automatically countering that. So that's one way. And, you know, and we do community in lots of other ways too. And so sometimes the example that I'll give that has nothing to do with my book whatsoever and everything to do with me is that I was in the marching band in college, and we called people sieves, which came from a hockey cheer where we talked about something falling through the goalie. So the goalie was a sieve if the other team's goalie was a sieve, if the puck went through. But that then becomes a word that we can use even, you know, as many years as I am out of college. But we all still use that to sort of say, hey, we were a part of this group. And so you have those sorts of things too.
Yeah. Carrie, what's one for you? What's a word that marks you as from British Columbia?
Skookum would be the easiest one.
What is it?
Really good, really strong. Skookum.
Is that from a First Nation?
It's from Chinook jargon, which is this mishmash of different languages, including some English and some French, but it's mostly, First Nations languages of the Pacific Northwest region.
Oh, that's amazing. Skookum?
Skookum.
I like that. So some of these things are placemaking in that they're putting us in a very, like people could guess pretty easily because it's so narrow, the place that you're indicating with something.
Exactly.
Just like New Jersey has something about, like, the day before Halloween that other people don't.
Devil's
Night? Devil's Night or Mischief Night, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the river. So it's the Anacostia River. How do people on either side, so what is the difference on the other side of the river? So we're talking about Anacostia, which is on one side, and then what's right on the other side?
So on the other side is DC Navy Yard and Waterfront. And so that is an area that has drastically changed. So when I moved to DC in 2008, either right then or right after then, I don't remember, and I should look up the statistic, in fact, but that was right when the new National Baseball Park opened.
Is that on that side of the...
That is on the other side. That is on the... it's on the white side of the river, if we think about my book as being the called the black side of the river. Yeah. So it's on the larger part of DC side of the Anacostia. It's on the west side. And so that, of course, then led to, you know, a food truck park that came next door, and then sushi places popping up and little craft beer places and things like that. All the things that tend to accompany places where young professionals want to go, especially young white professionals. So that's the opposite side, and it's always contained a higher percentage of white population than the Anacostia side of the river, the Anacostia neighborhood side of the Anacostia River, but it wasn't quite as stark prior to the 2000s. And in the 2000s was really when lots of parts of the city really started to take off in terms of gentrification. And it really changed who was living where. And you can look at some maps of the city from that time and see these areas that had these huge African-American populations on the eastern side of the city. The western side of the city has always had a relatively small African-American population, except for Georgetown, interestingly, which is now known as one of the whitest areas of the city. But you can sort of see the black population start to move east and south. And so then, of course, they end up in southeast by the time I was doing my research.
So you bring up gentrification, and also in the book it comes up a lot. So how does a gentrification impact language use, at least in D.C.?
It changes more of the ways that people are talking about things more than how they talk in particular ways. I was hoping to find, like, oh, it's going to change, like, how people talk. That is not what actually happens. But it does change how people need to construct their neighborhood presence. For instance, when I talked about some of these morphosyntactic things that people are doing, where they're using more features of AAL when they talk about certain topics, that actually does have a teeny bit of a class element to it, which is that you see it happen with the middle class residents of this neighborhood, sort of as this way of doing this really subtly, because they otherwise could be seen as gentrifiers, because they were often people in their 20s and 30s, these working professionals who otherwise fit the bill, right? They're people who, you know, might not want a Whole Foods in their neighborhood, sort of, but also do cross the river to go shop at the other Whole Foods. Like, they like Whole Foods. And so, like, they're that kind of population. And so this really subtle use of AAL lets them do both of those identities at once and kind of say, okay, like, yeah, I'm a lawyer, and yeah, I do yoga, and, you know, all these other things that we associate with the kinds of people who gentrify, but I'm not a gentrifier. I belong here.
And so I want to go back to the enunciate your endings. So you say someone like Michelle Obama is enunciating her endings, and probably because of this messaging that you're going to have to talk a certain way to succeed or, you know, get where you need to get. Is there an opposite effect where you may be, quote unquote, sounding white, but then that is kind of seen as a negative in the African-American community?
I think it really depends from community to community. So an example from the book, one of my interviewees, Tana, who is, it's actually really interesting. She's now, when I met her, she was just finishing a bachelor's degree as a non-traditionally aged student. And now she has a doctorate of education. And so she really belongs to this middle to upper class set population. And she said that for her, and this plays into what the two sides of the rivers are as well, for her, she would cross into the other parts of Northwest, cross the river to go to her middle school. And her middle school was very racially diverse. And she had gotten these messages from her parents. Her mother was a teacher. Her father was an engineer. She had gotten these messages from her parents about how she was supposed to sound. She even quotes, she's like, yeah, we were told don't say ain't. We weren't allowed to use nicknames. We weren't allowed to use slang.
Nicknames.
Everybody has nicknames.
What? Nicknames. Yeah.
But not the right kind of nicknames, Carrie.
I guess.
Sure. What?
Yeah. So she wasn't allowed to use nicknames and slang and all of these things. She had these very specific injunctions that went along with the way that she was supposed to sound. And so she talks about having to sound one way at school and another way at home and another way with her friends at home. And so she had three, she even calls it different Tanas. And I think that stayed in as a section title in my book. It certainly was in a couple of the drafts. It talked about different Tanas. And so there was a Tana that was at school with these mostly white Latinx students on the other side of the river. There was a Tana that was at home with her parents, who keyed off of that one that was at school, because it was very much an expectation of more standardized white varieties of English. And then the Tana who was outside with her friends playing jump rope. And so this need to, in the past we've used the term code switching. There's been a lot of really good pushback on this idea of code switching as being, reinforcing this idea that there's a right way to sound in some places and a wrong way to sound in others, like by the work of April Baker Bell, for instance, and recently. Yeah, so good.
So good.
And so I'm trying to get away from using that term too and really think about instead as she had these multiple very rich repertoires and had the linguistic capacity to draw on those repertoires variably depending on what community she was being a part of at the time.
You know, this reminds me of is Angie Thomas's YA book, The Hate U Give.
Yep.
The main character, Star, has this exact thing, except she's not in a racially diverse high school. She's in a white high school.
Right. I went to a really similar high school, and I saw so much of myself in that book. It was fascinating.
You also talk about language change. How does language change as a result of trying to show belonging?
I mean, the really interesting thing about these sorts of questions of belonging, like, one of the things I want to make sure that I talk about when it comes to, like, final consonant devoicing is that it ends up being a marker of Black English. And so it's really interestingly this attempt to not use some features of Black language, and so not use this coronal stop deletion, not say your West Psi or something like that. And so you get these folks who are getting this message, oh, I need to not do that. And so they do this other thing. But then they do this other thing in a way that other thing also gets marked as part of Black language. And that's really fascinating. And so, again, are we going to see this happening with language change because of gentrification? I would imagine that we will in certain kinds of ways. But sometimes there's also retention as well. And so, you know, the fact that you decide to keep some of these features of Black language, even as a neighborhood starts to gentrify and starts to become a little whiter, I would imagine we're going to see some of that as things move forward. There's a study I adore by Kara Becker. In it, she was looking at the same neighborhood that LeBove looked at in his really like quintessential, the foundational R-listness studies in the 1960s. And she went back in early 2000s, mid-2000s, studies from 2009. And recorded people that same neighborhood. And what had happened was people had kept the R-listness, this old sort of working class white R-listness that was characteristic of DC in the 60s, as a way of saying that they were from the neighborhood. And so it was this very hyper local, like, the East Side is gentrifying. I'm going to hold on to this thing that shows that I'm here. I think it's too early in DC's process, and particularly in Southeast DC's process, to see if something like that is going to happen, but I would suspect that it probably will.
Is it fair to say that language change might actually look like not changing?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah, it looks like holding on to these things. One of my favorite things that came out of my interviews was that people used the word bastion Which I was, I mean, this is a very strange, unusual word for people to pull out of their lexical repertoire, as it were. But I had multiple people from different sub-communities within the community, different ages, different socioeconomic classes, and they talked about the neighborhood as being the bastion, the last bastion of Black culture in D.C. And so I think you get language playing into that where people go, okay, I've got to, we have to hang on to who we are and doing that through language.
I read that part and I was like, oh, this doesn't seem that strange to me. And then I thought, oh, maybe like I just have the same kind of feelings. Like I would use that word for this exact context. Like there's something about that context that like pulls that word out of you.
Exactly. Yeah. It just really does feel like it's, something is starting to become unstable and starting to change. And so one of the things that it did not make it into the book, a change that is currently underway, and this has been one of the only upsides to the pandemic with regard to fieldwork, is that there's been a debate about whether or not to call the neighborhood something different. Not the actual, like, Anacostia will stay, but that side, the entire eastern side of the river, has often been called East of the River. That's even the name of their community newspaper is called East of the River. And there are some people who want to call it River East. And it, like, you can almost hear, you can hear the Whole Foods in River East.
Yes, I was going to say, that's exactly that. Community.
Yeah.
It sounds rich.
It sounds rich, right? And so there have been all of these debates about this naming process. And what would happen was I would go and do field work and I would be in the city for 3 or 4 weeks at a time. Now that I'm at the University of Tennessee and having to drive 7 hours to get there. And so I would be there for a couple weeks at a time and I would manage to make it to like one of these discussion meetings, maybe if I was very lucky and they didn't get it canceled. And so one of the upsides of the pandemic is that I've been able to attend all of these meetings on Zoom regularly and listen to the debates happen.
Are they recorded?
Some of them are, and so I can actually go back and get the ways that people are talking about it. So, articles in the future, they didn't make it into the book because this debate is being hotly contested right now.
That is very interesting. I wonder how you have tried to belong in your new geographical region, where you are now.
Yeah, I will say that my y'alling has increased at about 600%. And so, I mean, for several reasons, you know, one, I've really been trying to be much more gender neutral and conscious of the full spectrum of gender in the way that I use language. And so that's a really wonderful switch from you guys, which is my more thing that I grew up with. But also, y'all is part of the African-American community and it's part of the Southern community. And so I get to do both of those parts of my identity by using that. And so I don't sound too fake. you know, I don't use Appalachian English phonology when I do it, so it's not "Hey y'all." But
okay. Is it the A that's the?
Yeah, I guess yeah. There's a particular A that goes on in this region, so that's happened a lot. Aside from that, not a ton. And so you know, there is there's a good amount of pushback. I mean, this is also a place where class and place are in conflict, and so. You have this, you know, I thought when I came to the University of Tennessee, you know, I was a teaching assistant when I was in grad school at Georgetown in D.C. And so I have these students who'd come from all over the country to go to Georgetown, mostly white, mostly very affluent kinds of students that Georgetown attracts. And so I would teach them about language ideologies and like, oh, well, all Englishes are equal. They'd go, oh, yeah, like all Englishes are equal. This is great. All varieties. Like I have. So I came to Tennessee and I was like, yes, it's going to be perfect. I'm going to work with students who really do speak a stigmatized variety of English and I'm going to heal them and like tell them that their English is okay. And they want to
stand and deliver.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I'll tell you, students who have learned to get rid of their Appalachian English and Southern English's varieties to get to a place like the University of Tennessee, they want nothing to do with you telling them that Southern English is okay. Because they worked real hard to not sound like Mama and Papa. And so it actually takes a lot of work to say, no, you sound fine, so do your grandparents, and we're going to honor everyone's language, and we're going to think about the different ways we use language as being our parts of ourselves and the ways that we connect ourselves to the places that we're from and the places that we are. And that's been more of a challenge here than I would have thought it would be. But this is also a wonderful place to be studying these things. But we're right next to Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge, which is where Dolly Parton is from. And so there's a huge part of performativeness of this. And so, so this is deep in the Appalachian Mountains, and there's a performative nature to Appalachian English in this region, because people are coming. There's a saying, the mountains are calling and I must go. And so people come here to go to the mountains, and they want the, y'all come back now, you hear? And that's what they're here for. That's what people here are here to deliver for them. And so that's a really interesting aspect, too.
Dolly Parton just keeps coming up.
I know, Appalachia, we just, Papaw, like, we were talking about that in another interview that we had. That's something that places you somewhere if you use it.
Exactly.
Talking about the mountains, here's something that might be in common between D.C. and people in Appalachia. Do you think the people in Appalachia also bring attention to how beautiful it is where they are from when other people are disparaging it?
Exactly, right? And so, and disparaging for much the same reasons. You know, this is coal country. This is, areas that are in extreme poverty in some parts of the country and some parts of this side of the state, in much the same way that for different reasons, you know, there you have the intergenerational effects of slavery and racism and Jim Crow laws and things like that happening in D.C., but you end up with this cross of extreme poverty in these locations. And so people go, okay, well, the location itself is bad. And instead, no, you gotta look at this, get up here, look in the mountains. Actually, a strange similarity is that because of the river basin in D.C., Anacostia, or parts of Anacostia, are actually very hilly. And so you get one of the best vistas in all of D.C. is from the first Black Catholic Church in Anacostia, Our Lady of Perpetual Help. And it is just, if you want to take a gorgeous panorama of downtown D.C., that's where you want to go, actually, and not into Virginia, and not into some of the places that other people think of as safer. And so, yeah, that same intersection happens here in East Tennessee, and that same pushback happens.
It's so interesting to me. I could talk about this all day. But what is something that you think, maybe from your book, that you want to mention, or just something that we didn't ask that we should have? What do you think we need to know?
Not really from my book even, but the thrust of what I'm working on now is thinking about the multiplicity of Black identity. And so, you know, you heard me talk in this interview about the ways that I was going in looking for class differences and didn't find them, and instead found these questions connected to Blackness and identities of place. And so it's really easy to think about race as being a category that you belong to. And of course, it was Ta-Nehisi Coates who said, you know, racism birthed race, not the other way around, right? And race is the product of racism. And so so are these categorizations where we think, okay, like Black people are a set of people, and then we can look at what Black people do. And linguists have fallen into that trap in a big way. And Black linguists have done it, and white linguists have done it, of thinking about, okay, there's a big monolithic community. And instead, I've really started to try to push back and think about race and racialization of all kinds as being something that we do, and something that intersects all the other things. So it means something different to be a Black woman than it means to be a Black man. It means something different to be Black in Appalachia, which is a subcommunity that's here, than to be Black in D.C. And so the ways that all of these things intersect affect the way that we use language and who we are when we do that.
What a great way to end.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, I am stopping myself from asking you more things from that because that is beautiful.
It was beautiful.
I am so happy for you. Congratulations on your book coming out.
Thanks, thanks. And if I ever get off my butt, I'll be really excited for yours too. So, yeah.
We always leave our listeners with one final message.
Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
You don't need the bullet when you got the ballot. Are you up for the downstroke, CC? Chocolate City. Are you with me out there? And when they come to march on you, tell them to make sure they got their James Brown.
This month, we would like to thank Language Guy.
Yay!
And Diego Diaz.
Yay! Thank you so much. I mean, other people can support us too. Where at?
Right. www.patreon.com/vocalfriespod. And we have stickers and we have bonus episodes and we have a mug.
We do. And it's cute. And salty.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at VocalFriesPod. You can email us at VocalFriesPod@gmail.com, and our website is VocalFriesPod.com.